comença Camps Magnètics, un programa de Ràdio 90 que parla de la relació entre la música, la ciència i la ciència-ficció. Camps Magnètics, 30 minuts on la música i la paraula es donen la mà a través dels 101.4 de la FM, amb guió de Josep Cuellar i locució d'Eva Ruiz.
Let's rock. The human has been neutralized.
Aquest programa que ara comença és un complement del programa número 8 de Camps Magnètics, emès per Ràdio 90, la primavera de l'any 2011. Però, per damunt de tot, vol ser un homenatge al gran escriptor i home de ciència Isaac Asimov, ara que celebrem aquest mes de gener del 2020 el centenari del seu naixement.
Intruder. Intruders must be destroyed. Intruders must be destroyed. Self-destruct initiated. Self-destruct initiated.
A Isaac Asimov se l'ha associat sempre amb el món dels robots, perquè va escriure molts relats sobre aquests enginys mecànics, però potser encara més perquè va establir les anomenades tres lleis de la robòtica. Deixem que ens les expliqui ell mateix, de la seva pròpia veu, pròpia Isaac Asimov.
The first law is as follows. A robot may not harm a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Number two, a robot must obey orders given it by qualified personnel unless those orders violate rule number one. In other words, a robot can't be ordered to kill a human being. Rule number three, a robot must protect its own existence, after all it's an expensive piece of equipment, unless that violates rules one or two. A robot must cheerfully go into self-destruction if it is in order to follow an order or to save a human life.
Sí, les tres lleis de la robòtica d'Isaac Asimov són molt conegudes, aquí ens l'explicava ell mateix, i també les vam enumerar nosaltres en aquell programa número 8 de Camps Magnètics. Primer, un robot no pot fer mal a un ésser humà o, per inacció, permetre que un ésser humà prengui mal. Segon, un robot ha d'obeir les ordres dels éssers humans, excepte si entren en conflicte amb la primera llei. I tercer, un robot ha de protegir la seva pròpia existència en la mesura que aquesta protecció no entri en conflicte amb la primera o la segona llei. Quines utilitats imaginava Asimov que tindrien els robots? L'any 1985 ho veia així, repetim, això era l'any 1985.
Well, the importance of robots is that they're going to do the kind of jobs that human beings oughtn't to do because it underuses the brain. And yet human beings have had to do it because neither animals nor machines are smart enough. Now we've got computerized machines, robots, that are smart enough to do this work.
Com gairebé sempre, Asimov encertava amb les seves previsions sobre els robots. Va escriure ell un grapat de relats sobre això, precisament, sobre els robots.
Robot Dreams by Isaac Asimov.
En algunes ocasions ho va fer posant-hi dosis d'ironia i de dramatisme alhora, com en el cas del que va titular Light Verse i que s'ha traduït per Rima Lleugera. lleugera, publicat l'any 1973, ens explica la història de la senyora Lardner, una dona encantadora i amb una intensa vida social, coneguda i apreciada sobretot per les seves escultures de llum i també pel fet de disposar d'una autèntica brigada de robots domèstics, els quals ella tracta com si fossin persones. Ningú no relaciona una cosa amb l'altra, escultures de llum i robots, però aleshores passen coses.
Mr. Travis arrived rather late. He had made one last attempt at a piece of light sculpture and had failed dismally. He greeted Mrs. Lardner with a kind of puzzled respect and said, "That was a peculiar robot who took my hat and coat." "That is Max," said Mrs. Lardner. "He is quite maladjusted, and he's a fairly old model. How is it you did not return it to the factory?" "Oh, no," said Mrs. Lardner. "It would be too much trouble." "None at all, Mrs. Lardner," said Travis. "You would be surprised how simple a task it was. Since I am with U.S. Robots, I took the liberty of adjusting him myself. It took no time, and you'll find he is now in perfect working order." A queer change came over Mrs. Lardner's face. Fury found a place on it for the first time in her gentle life, and it was as though the lines did not know how to form. "You adjusted him?" she shrieked. "But it was he who created my light sculptures. It was the maladjustment, which you can never restore, that... It was really unfortunate that she had been showing her collection at the time, and that the jeweled dagger from Cambodia was on the marble tabletop before her. Travis's face was also distorted. "You mean if I had studied his uniquely maladjusted positronic brain paths, I might have learned..." She lunged with the knife too quickly for anyone to stop her, and he did not try to dodge. Some said he came to meet it, as though he wanted to die.
Sí, doncs el senyor Travis, pensant fer-li un favor a la senyora Lardner, s'endú d'amagat un dels robots per corregir-li uns desajustaments. I quan el torna a la propietària, ella esclata d'ira fins al punt que es llança damunt d'ell amb una daga i acaba amb la seva vida, la vida del senyor Travis. Per què aquella fúria? Doncs perquè, com sentíem en aquest fragment d'aquest relat, rima lleugera, justament aquell robot anomenat Max era el que creava les seves tan admirades escultures de llum. Era ell, era Max, el robot.
Robot Dreams by Isaac Asimov.
Sí, els relats d'Asimov, com aquest que hem sentit rima lleugera, han inspirat a molta gent. També han inspirat a músics com Alan Parsons, que l'any 1977, amb la seva formació Alan Parsons Project, enreglava aquest mític iRobot. Eric Wolfson, col·lega de Parsons en aquesta aventura Alan Parsons Project, explicava així com va néixer la idea de fer aquesta peça inspirada en l'obra d'Asimov.
"We had intended just calling the album Tales of Mystery and Imagination, but the record company specifically asked us to have an artistic identification, so we called it the Alan Parsons Project. And people in the industry and the public appeared to think of this as being a band. This was quite fortuitous because during the making of the album, we realized that there was more scope for this kind of musical venture, and we developed many other ideas for making albums based on different themes. As Edgar Allan Poe had been described as the father of science fiction, it seemed reasonably logical that we should perhaps go into the science fiction area for the next album, and the result was the iRobot album."
Thank you.
Isaac Asimov was one of the first science fiction writers to predict that, and he imagines even more sophisticated robots in the future.
Through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. Number two, a robot must obey orders given it by qualified personnel, unless those orders violate rule number one. In other words, a robot can't be ordered to kill a human being. Rule number three, a robot must protect its own existence at false and expensive risk.
Però a Isaac Asimov també li interessaven altres coses a part dels ordinadors i els robots. De fet, va escriure sobre pràcticament tot. I també li preocupava molt el canvi climàtic, i això ja als anys 80. En aquella època va gravar un missatge alertant sobre els perills de destruir el nostre propi planeta i sobre la necessitat d'unir forces, tota la raça humana, per fer front a aquest gran repte. Un missatge que recentment Melody Sheep, és a dir, John D. Boswell, ha recuperat en forma de vídeo i embolcallant-ho amb una música èpica. Aquest és aquell missatge que ens oferia Asimov.
The world has become so fragile that we cannot subject the earth to the tortures we can now inflict upon it. We are actually tampering with the climate of the earth and with the very atmosphere that we breathe. Not only are we piling in more and more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but we are chopping down the forests of the earth at a great rate. And these problems are life and death problems. They go to the root of the viability of the planet itself, making the earth a lot less livable. We are facing problems that transcend nations. When we talk about the greenhouse effect, we're talking about something that affects the entire Earth. All human beings are facing the same problems. It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit. The problems with the ocean, with the atmosphere, with the population, with pollution. The only way we can solve a problem is by a human solution, a cooperative solution. There's one thing that is biologically certain about the human species is that it is a human species. One species. Who is going to lead in the directions? Never can we sit back and wait for miracles to save us. Miracles don't happen. Sweat happens. Efforts happen. Thought happens. And it's up to us to help. Have all that happen.
One Species, aquest era el missatge ecològic d'Isaac Asimov, un missatge avui, per cert, de plena actualitat. Però si d'una cosa va escriure amb autèntica passió Isaac Asimov al llarg de la seva vida, va ser del món de l'espai. Planetes, estrelles i galàxies ocupen centenars de pàgines dels seus llibres i articles de divulgació, i són també el rerefons de gran part de les seves novel·les i relats. Viatgem, doncs, a l'espai. Què tal a la Lluna? De l'Apollo 11 se n'ha parlat molt aquests darrers mesos. L'arribada a la Lluna era el moment culminant d'una aventura que havia començat l'any 1962 amb aquell famós discurs del president John Fitzgerald Kennedy que deia "We choose to go to the moon". Hem escollit anar a la Lluna.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills.
I just en aquelles mateixes dates de l'arribada a la Lluna, li van preguntar a Isaac Asimov en una entrevista a la televisió si ell havia previst en alguna de les seves obres un moment com aquell. Ara sentirem el que va contestar Asimov. I disculpeu, amics, la qualitat del so, però és que estem a l'any 1969.
Well, I tell you, back in 1939 I wrote a story about the first trip to the moon. I placed it in 1973, which shows the crackpot though I was very conservative. The only thing was I followed science fiction tradition by having the first spaceship built by a sole inventor, a lone eagle type fellow, who built it out of old tin cans in his backyard.
Having reached this plateau, this lunar plateau, immediately it comes to mind.
Però el presentador vol saber més coses, més opinions del seu convidat.
We have touched upon the moon. We have, in a sense, predicted it as science fiction writers. I use the collective, respectful we here, not certainly not me. What do you write about next? Where does man go in his science fiction beyond the moon? Isaac?
Well, one of the things I've made use of a great deal has been the man-like robot with man-like intelligence. Now, this is still in the future, and on the other hand, it's still something we're likely to accomplish. So I, for one, plan to stand pat on this to a great degree. I shall continue writing robot stories. I think that for my lifetime anyway, they'll remain science fiction.
Aquest que hem sentit, doncs, és un document en certa manera històric pels amants de la ciència-ficció, o almenys pels seguidors d'Isaac Asimov. Però ara deixarem enrere l'Apollo 11, tan famós i conegut, i ens quedarem una estona, uns moments, amb la missió que fins ara, l'última missió que fins ara ha trepitjat la Lluna, l'Apollo 17, d'això n'ha fet ara 47 anys. Sí, concretament el dia 7 de desembre de 1972, l'Apollo 17 s'enlairava en direcció a la Lluna. Com dèiem, era la darrera missió de la sèrie Apollo, el darrer viatge planejat cap al nostre satèl·lit. I molt important això, l'únic que s'enlairava en plena nit. Contemplar aquest gran espectacle es va organitzar un creuer per les costes de Florida. S'hi va convidar escriptors famosos com Norman Mailer o Catherine Ann Porter, també astrònoms com el conegut Carl Sagan i altres personatges de nom importants. El món de la ciència-ficció també era molt ben representat i eren Frederick Pohl, Robert A. Heinlein, Theodore Sturgeon i, naturalment, Isaac Asimov. L'objectiu d'aquest creuer no era tan sols contemplar com l'Apollo 17 s'elevava cap al cel, sinó aprofitar la benentesa per celebrar en el propi vaixell conferències, debats, festes i fins i tot excursions a platges properes. De tot això en vam parlar ja en aquell programa número 8 de Cants Magnètics i que encara es pot escoltar entrant a l'arxiu de la web de Ràdio 90. Però llavors no teníem el document que sentirem ara, un document sonor que recull parts d'aquell creuer tan especial. Comença la gravació amb el so de la sirena del vaixell. Després sentirem l'ambient de la sala amb els diferents convidats departint alegrement amb una copa a la mà. Interessant el que comenten sobre la intel·ligència extraterrestre. Al final acaben cantant tots plegats. Seguint l'enlairament de l'Apollo 17 el 1972, ara sentim l'ambient a la coberta del vaixell Sentirem sortir l'Apolo, veus, exclamacions de joia, comentaris.
The flight of Apollo 17, right up from almost, it seemed from the sea, we watched it from his ship, it was given by my little boy Andros. Andros created a poem. Somebody asked him after the shot what he saw, and he said this: Rocket a moon.
Impressionat per l'espectacle, Simó fa el seu comentari en calent.
The entire sea, it blanked out the entire sky, and the most exciting part was when the sound reached us, because I assumed it was going to be silent. There it went off in the distance, I didn't hear a thing, and I forgot, and suddenly we were washed over by this thunder. That was frightening.
Una sèrie de personalitats realment privilegiades que van poder assistir doncs, a aquest creuer per contemplar de molt a prop, en primera línia, l'enlairament de l'Apolo 17 el desembre de 1972, entre ells Isaac Asimov. Després el creuer va continuar per les costes de Florida, van arribar fins i tot a Puerto Rico i van tenir molt de temps i molta ocasió per parlar del sentit de la missió i en general de l'exploració del sistema solar i de l'espai. Asimov no es va quedar només amb el breu comentari improvisat davant el micròfon que hem sentit abans, ho va escriure. Va desaparèixer d'un cap a l'altre. Nosaltres i el vaixell i tot el món visible ens van trobar de cop i volta coberts per un cel color coure del qual se n'havien esborrat les estrelles, mentre sota els nostres peus el mar es tornava de color taronja grisós. En un silenci d'allò més profund, aquell sol artificial que havia fet canviar tant el nostre món més proper es va aixecar més i més, i després, 40 segons després de l'ignició, una violenta sacsejada de l'aire que envoltava els motors del coet es va obrir pas a través de les 7 milles de mar que ens separaven de la costa i va arribar on érem nosaltres. El coet ja era molt amunt quan vam ser sacsejats per un tro fortíssim. Amb la qual cosa el nostre privat i transitori dia es va veure acompanyat per un terratrèmol privat i transitori. El so i la llum eren del tot majestuosos mentre el coet s'anava aixecant fins a esdevenir un boldró vermellós allà en el cel. Tornava a fer-se de nit. Van sortir les estrelles i el mar es va enfosquir. Hi hagué un llampec en el cel quan es va encendre la segona fase i el coet es va convertir en una estrella més entre les estrelles, movent-se i movent-se i movent-se i fent-se cada cop més imperceptible. En aquells moments era inútil parlar perquè no hi havia res a dir, no s'havien inventat els mots i les frases que poguessin servir d'acompanyament a aquest magnífic salt a la Lluna, i jo no vaig intentar d'inventar-ne cap.
December 6, 1972. Eugene Cernan, veteran astronaut and commander of Apollo 17. He would be the last Apollo astronaut to stand on the surface of the moon. Dr. Harrison Schmitt, better known as Jack. He would be the first geologist to set foot on an alien world. Ronald Evans, command module pilot. He would remain in lunar orbit, operating a battery of experiments that would take this last close look at the moon.
Vàrem somiar que podíem escoltar una ràdio diferent, lliure, cultural i que no sonés com la resta.
It starts with one thing, I don't know why, it doesn't matter how hard you try.
Una ràdio feta a partir de les emocions dels seus col·laboradors, autèntica en els seus continguts i allunyada de la comercialitat. Una ràdio on l'únic compte de resultats és a partir de la generositat i l'altruisme. En despertar i veure que només era un somni, decidirem fer-lo realitat, i així va néixer Ràdio 90. Una ràdio feta a mà, per ser compartida a través del 101.4 de la FM i per internet a r90.org. Ràdio 90, la ràdio lliure i cultural de la Garrotxa. Comparteix-la.
Camps magnètics.
En el interior del sobrecalentado núcleo de este planeta, la rotación del metal fundido crea un escudo invisible que rodea el globo. Es el campo magnético de la Tierra.
Camps magnètics.
My name is Isaac Asimov, and I've been asked to read a few of my stories to you. I don't know which of my stories you like best, so what I've done is to pick out some of the stories I like and hope that you have the same tastes as I do.
quería preguntarle en primer lugar al señor Asimov cuántos libros ha escrito y en cuántos idiomas han sido traducidas sus obras.
Yesterday I received my 256th book. That's how many have been published.
Ayer me entregaron mi libro número 256. Estos son los publicados hasta ahora, pero yo añadiría otros 15 que tengo terminados y entregados. Así que en total son unos 275. Approaching 275th.
You're talking about the fact that you've written 221 books
so far.
So far, is that a compulsive behavior? Do you think?
I enjoy it. You know, why not?
Sure.
But I say to myself, here I am, a handsome writer. Why shouldn't I write?
Yeah. What kind of schedule do you put in to write that many books?
I get up in the morning, sit down, and write. When I finish writing, go back to bed.
I was born 50 miles south of Smolensk, or 230 miles southwest of Moscow.
Came to the United States when you were how old?
3 years.
Yeah. Parents immigrated?
It was several years after the revolution. We came in 1923. And so my native language is English. I remember nothing about the Soviet Union.
And you wanted to be a writer very early.
11 years old, I started writing.
Yeah. First book published, what, about 1950?
Well, that was the first book published in 1950 when I was 30 years old, but I had been publishing in the magazine short stories for 11 years before that. My first short story was sold professionally in 1938, so that I'm rapidly approaching my 50th anniversary as a professional writer.
Thank you.
When you look at the people that have influenced you, who's had the most influence?
Well, aside from my father
and mother.
Yeah, well, John Campbell. He was the editor of Astounding Science Fiction from 1938 to 1971.
Astounding Science Fiction.
Right. Yeah. And I brought in my first story on June 17th, 1938. He'd only been the editor for a few months, and he took me in hand for some reason. And in a sense, jollied me along, made sure I kept my nose stuck to the grindstone, encouraged me, discussed my stories with me, and to coin a phrase, made me what I am today. Really, the glory of science, that science is tentative, that it is not certain, that it is subject to change. What is really, in my way of thinking, disgraceful is to have a set of beliefs that you think is absolute and has been so from the start and can't change, where you simply won't listen to evidence. You say, if the evidence agrees with me, it's not necessary. If it doesn't agree with me, it's false. Science fiction has always, in the past, seemed to be nothing but an exercise of the imagination.
La ciencia ficción se consideraba antes como un simple ejercicio de fantasía, pero en los últimos 30 o 40 años se ha visto que temas considerados como simple ciencia ficción se han hecho realidad.
People have reached the moon. People do have computers and robots working for them. So that people now can see.
El hombre ha llegado a la luna. Tiene robots y computadoras que trabajan para él. De modo que la imaginación del escritor de ciencia ficción acerca. Puede que realidad y ciencia ficción se acerquen, pero nunca se alcanzarán, ya que la misión del escritor es la de ir más allá.
They'll never become identical. They may approach in some ways, but it's the job of the science fiction writer to go further than science is, wherever it is.
I think that serious fiction, fiction where the writer feels he's accomplishing something besides simply amusing people, but there's nothing wrong with simply amusing people. But if he thinks that he's doing something besides simply amusing people, what he's doing is holding up a mirror to the human species, making it possible for you to understand people better because you've read the novel or the story, maybe making it possible for you to understand yourself better. This is an important thing. Now, science fiction uses a different method for doing this. It works up an artificial society, one which doesn't exist, one which may possibly exist in the future, but not necessarily. And it portrays events against the background of this society. Well, it's amusing, it's interesting, but in the hope that this will give a new way of looking at people, at looking at yourself, that you will see yourself seen against this strange society in ways you couldn't possibly see yourself seen against the present society.
My name is Isaac Asimov, and I've been asked to read a few of my stories to you.